This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Behind every fight for human rights is a person with their own story of resilience and conviction. And Professor Paula Gerber has carried that fight for decades. And in her new book, Sex, Gender and Identity, Trans Rights in Australia, Paula shines a light on the challenges facing trans communities. But today, we're going to go deeper into what motivates Paula, where it began, and what keeps her hope alive. Paula, welcome to the Drive Studio.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Warren.
Now, Paula, before we get into the book, you're an ABBA fan.
I am an ABBA fan.
So am I.
Growing up in the 1980s, that's what happened.
Do you know, it was Moomba, I think, 1976 or 77, and my parents were carrying me over the bridge over the Yarra up to the Maya Music Bowl. Guess who was performing? ABBA.
No.
Oh, they were. And I remember sitting on my dad's shoulders watching them perform. I think it was, one of their ballads. It was absolutely beautiful.
Oh, so their voices are amazing.
They are amazing. Now, let's talk about you. Before we get into your work, were there moments early on in your life where you noticed issues of fairness and injustice?
Absolutely. I grew up in a family in Queensland under Joe Bjelke-Petersen was premier, and I had a father who was a lawyer, and he fought long and hard for the underdog. And one of the first things I remember is him taking me along to the Bellevue Hotel, which was being demolished in the middle of the night, this historic building, heritage protected, and Joe Bjelke-Petersen just decided he wanted to develop the site and knocked it down in the middle of the night. And my dad asked the security guards that were there if they could give us a couple of bricks because he wanted souvenirs of this historic building. So that's one memory. He was a criminal barrister. Instead of taking us to, footy games on the weekend, he took us to prison, to Boggar Road Jail. And I watched, people being imprisoned in very inhumane conditions. And on top of that, he was a refugee. He came to Australia as a 14-year-old Jewish boy from Germany, didn't speak a word of English, was persecuted and bullied because he was German. Mm. Being the daughter of a refugee and a Holocaust survivor definitely influenced my career choice.
Now, was there a clear turning point when you knew you wanted to make human rights law your life's work?
Yes, but it came later in life. I was a lawyer, and I'd fallen into construction law, and I was doing all these.
It's the bricks.
The bricks was probably a good point. And I had been working as a solicitor in London and an attorney in LA, and I came back to Australia, and I thought, I've had enough of this, and I considered other career choices like teaching English as a second language or doing an MBA or something. And a friend of mine said, you still love the law. You just don't want to be a construction lawyer anymore. Find a different area of law. And so I enrolled in a master's degree, and the first subject I did was international human rights law, and that was it. I'd drunk the Kool-Aid, and I've been doing it now for a couple of decades.
And if you've got a construction problem, 0427. No, we're not going to open the lines to that at all. I suppose with the issues you deal with, I mean, construction law it sounds like a completely different sort of kettle of fish to what you deal with now. I imagine, dealing with violence, discrimination, hostility, how do you personally carry that weight? Because it's a lot to deal with, or does it just motivate you more?
I think the working in construction for a while actually was a good training ground for this. I set up, when I came back to Australia, the National Association of Women in Construction, because I had seen how misogynistic the toxic masculinity of the construction profession, and it hasn't changed that much in a long time, and women are still a minority and they're still treated pretty poorly a lot of the time. So I'd had that exposure to discrimination against women, and then you add another layer of sexual orientation or gender identity on top of that, and it really lit a fire in my belly, and I wanted to do what I could to change things.
And it's that toxic masculinity, isn't it, that permeates right throughout society. It doesn't matter where it is.
Absolutely.
It discriminates against other people wherever it lands.
It does, and it's, I think, a bigger problem in Australia perhaps than in some other countries. I mention in the book the Scandinavian countries, where they have for a long time really inculcated gender equality, and it informs all their legislation, all their policies, and as a result you have a very different society than what we see in Australia.
Now, Paula, you've made the switch to the human rights law side of things. Do you remember the first case or the judgment that made you think, you know what, this is why justice matters?
Toonen in Australia. I could not believe that in my lifetime, in my country, it was still a crime to be gay in Tasmania. And so when the UN, the peak international body, said, Australia, you are violating human rights by criminalising consensual same-sex sexual conduct between men. And I thought, wow, you can make a difference by using the law to combat human rights violations.
We're chatting with Professor Paula Gerber, legal scholar, human rights advocate and author of Sex, Gender and Identity, Trans Rights in Australia, exploring her personal story, her motivations and how she sees the world we live in today. Did you ever imagine that your work would take you all the way to writing books and influencing national conversations?
Not at all. I did my PhD on human rights education, and I was very much focused on education being the key to changing society. We can't have a human rights respecting culture if we don't know about our human rights. So it's really important that we educate children about human rights. So I was very much into the teaching side of being an academic, and I more sort of stumbled into writing and realised that actually I've got a lot to say. And so I started writing a lot of books, and amazingly people have read them.
Now, you reflect in the book on the progress for LGBTIQ plus Australians, but also the setbacks for trans and gender diverse people. What gives you, when you see that, it's almost like you've got one thing going in a positive direction, and then you've got something else going in a negative direction. How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel angry. It makes me feel like I want to do something about that, because as a lesbian, I have seen my rights be increasingly respected and much greater acceptance by society. The marriage equality campaign, I think, was a big turning point for that. As much as I opposed putting it out for a postal survey, it did educate people. It did change hearts and minds, the whole campaign leading up to that. And I've seen the expungement of convictions for gay men. I've seen an apology from Dan Andrews. I was sitting in Parliament when that happened. And the one part of the LGBTIQA plus community that I haven't really seen have that change, that progress in the way their rights are respected, is the trans community. And I thought it was time that I spoke up about that.
Why is it that trans rights are almost seen like an argument? Why are trans people themselves are seen like something that has to be won? What's that about?
That's a really good question. There's such a small minority. 0.9% of our population identifies as trans. You know, and when you talk about trans women, it's not even enough to fill the MCG stadium. And yet they seem to evoke such hostility and seen as a threat rather than them being the victims of a lot of hate and discrimination and bigotry. And I'm not a psychologist. I don't understand the psychology behind all this hate. My lay assessment is that people like to feel superior to someone, and this seems like an easy target to say, I'm better than you, and you're not legitimate, and you're not normal, quotation marks.
It's a lot harder, isn't it, I suppose, to build yourself up from within to make yourself feel better. It's a lot easier to pull someone else down. It's much simpler, less energy required. Do you think there's some of that going on in there as well? I know I'm not a psychologist either, but just thinking about it.
It seems that way. And also perhaps a bit of self-loathing and self-hatred that is externalised, and trans people are seen as an easy punching bag, it appears.
Now, you dedicate the book to the courage of trans people living their truth. What did writing that dedication mean to you?
It was really important to me. I have come to know a lot of trans people in my work in LGBTIQ space, and without exception, I find them to be incredibly strong and resilient people, and I really admire them, and I want them to know that there are some members of the LGBTIQ community who oppose trans rights, and that really troubles me. And so I wanted them to know that they are respected, they are loved, and they are admired by me.
If someone picks up the book and they put it down, they say, you know what, I now understand it. What is it that you hope they understand?
I hope they understand that sex is not a binary. That's the number one lesson I want them to get out of this. There's so much misinformation and disinformation out there that you're either male or female. And one of the things I say in the book is we wouldn't classify people as either old or young or tall or short. They're spectrums, and so is sex, and so is gender. And it is much easier just to accept and love and respect and be kind to people and not to demonise and vilify people.
We're chatting with Professor Paula Gerber, legal scholar, human rights advocate and author of Sex, Gender and Identity, Trans Rights in Australia. When you look around the country now, Paula, what do you see as the biggest threats to human rights? Is it here or is it mainly overseas?
I think we are at a turning point where we really need to make sure that a lot of the toxicity that we're seeing overseas is not imported into Australia. We had a resounding election result earlier this year where the divisive politics of Peter Dutton was roundly rejected by the electorate, and 120 politicians or political candidates signed a trans justice pledge to support trans rights. And I think that we have the foundation for a really human rights respecting society. But it is, we can't take it for granted, because I think in America they took it for granted. I think in the UK they took it for granted. And we've seen how quickly things can change if you've got a leader or a court that is not going to respect trans rights.
And we're watching globally pushback against trans rights, also women's rights as well, and even democratic rights that's happening around the world. Do you feel we're moving here in Australia? We haven't imported a lot of it, but there are fringe groups wanting to import a lot of it. Do you think we have the potential to move backwards if we do let our guard down?
If we let our guard down, absolutely. And I think it's time for allies to stand up, to speak up, and to fight not just for trans rights, but also for all human rights, for all vulnerable groups, whether it's First Nations people or refugees and asylum seekers or women. It's time that we stand up and protect human rights for all. And one of the things that I advocate for, not so much in this book, but more generally, is that we need a Human Rights Act. We are the only Western country in the world that does not have a Bill of Rights at the federal, national level. So I'd like to see that happen to really secure our human rights and protect them.
I was going to say, what difference would that make to this country if we did have it, for those who don't understand what one is?
Well, to link it back to what my PhD was on human rights education, my thesis looked at the extent to which children in secondary school in Boston learn about human rights compared to students in secondary schools in Melbourne. And what I realised is that the students in the US learn a lot more about human rights because they have a Bill of Rights. There's something that they can hang their hat on, that they can use as a teaching tool. So not having one in Australia really makes it harder to incorporate human rights into our curriculum.
Paula, I feel for young people growing up today when they see what's going on in the world. And I wonder what your message would be to someone who's young, who perhaps is listening and thinking, you know, I'm getting all these mixed messages that there's something wrong with me. What would you say to them?
One of the chapters that I really enjoyed researching and writing about in the book was the history chapter. And what that reveals is that for as long as humans have walked this earth, there have been people who've had diverse genders. And we can learn a lot from history. We've won a lot of battles. We've made progress. It's fragile. We need to keep fighting for and progressing our rights, but you're not alone. There is a long history and a big community out there in the world that are just like you.
Finally, how do you imagine Australia in, say, 10 or 20 years' time? What kind of country do you hope we are for anyone, whether they be trans, gender diverse, anyone in the community? What do you think, where could we be in 10, 20 years if we do it right?
if we do it right, we could have much greater gender equality across the society as a whole, in Parliament, in the construction sector, in the mining sector. I would like us to look towards the Scandinavian countries and to learn, watch and learn from them. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. I would like to see a country where every state and territory has a treaty with the First Nations people, which Victoria is on the cusp of achieving. And I'd like us to see a Human Rights Act that really educates people about human rights, and people know and respect human rights for people with disabilities, for people from different backgrounds, and everyone is just respected as fundamentally we're all human beings.
Paul, I was going to ask you what brings you joy outside of the law, but I reckon it's a set of headphones. Listening to ABBA songs, am I right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Is that your number one? Yeah, I agree with you. Congratulations on the book. How's it feel launching it tonight here at the Victorian Pride Centre?
Very exciting, a bit nerve-wracking. I'm having a conversation with Joe Ball, our LGBTIQA plus commissioner, and it feels great to have this, my baby, out in the world.
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us too on Joy Drive. We always enjoy having conversations with you.
It's always my pleasure, Warren.
That's Professor Paula Gerber, legal scholar, human rights advocate and author of Sex, Gender and Identity, Trans Rights in Australia. Paula, actually one more, the most important question. What ABBA track am I going to put on the turntable?
You're going to put on The Winner Takes It All.
Oh, here it
is.
You
can't beat it.
Thanks, Paula.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.